You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
In other news, statistics from the New Zealand Family Violence Clearinghouse reveal an alarming reality about family violence in New Zealand. So it seems that frontline police officers are spending 41% of their on-duty time responding to family violence, and police family violence call-outs also increased by more than 8,000 in 2015 from the previous year, and then by another 8,000 the year after in 2016. And so Dr. Pauline Gulliver,
Who's sitting right behind you now?
Hope I get all this right. From the Clearinghouse says the increase could be a rise in incidents or a rise in people coming forward, but that nevertheless we need better resourcing for specialist family violence services and prevention programs. And so, of course, you guys are going to be talking about that a little bit more shortly.
Yes.
But also Daniel Walker, who's producing The Wire today, will be hopefully getting another perspective on the issue. And so he's sort of tracking that down at the moment as we speak. But yeah, very sort of shocking statistics there that are, yeah, quite upsetting.
We should be fucking ashamed of ourselves.
Mm.
There we go. That's my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious, though. I mean, I don't know if Pauline would like to pitch in on this, but I recently interviewed Tracy Martin last week about the anti-smacking law, and I wonder if that has something to do with how with an increase in reporting. Is that possibly, if you want to come over, share Sam's mic?
You can take over.
I mean, to be honest, we don't actually know because we don't track these things well enough. My gut instinct would be that I would be very surprised if the anti-smacking law had a significant impact on
right.
these figures here.
Okay.
These are police family violence call-outs, so they're generally around male assaults, females type stuff. Though there is, you know, there is some child abuse in there as well. I think we don't know enough to say that. I think that there's a bigger social issue at foot rather than just one particular policy change.
Yeah.
You know, when we don't address housing, we don't address family violence. When we don't address pay equity, we don't address family violence. When we don't address poverty, we don't address family violence. So we're talking large-scale social issues, and I don't think that we're actually adequately addressing any of those at the moment.
Mm. Cool, thank you.
And yeah. we will talk at length about that very shortly.
Sorry if I stole one of your questions there.
Okay. You're in charge.
Questions are all around us.
Learn.
Why is liquid cold?
Learn.
What is maths?
Learn.
Why does this, ow, hurt?
Learn.
What is the Enlightenment?
I don't know.
And now, thanks to the University of Auckland, it's time to ready, steady, learn!
And it's time to ready, steady, learn. Our guest in the studio is Dr. Pauline Gulliver, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very
morning.
Much for having me.
It's a big morning for you. You've got some. You're basically the harbinger of doom when it comes to these figures, isn't it? This is firstly, what's your who do you represent?
So I'm here from the Family Violence Clearinghouse, New Zealand.
The Family Violence Clearinghouse.
Yes. So we collate and disseminate information about family violence in New Zealand. So each year we put together a series of data summaries, and they're essentially supposed to be a summary of publicly available information about family violence, you know, the trend, information that government agencies collect, and we just make it accessible.
Well, just to start, where did the Family Violence Clearinghouse, how did that begin? Is it the sort of thing that every country has, or
every country has one. Ours first began in Christchurch,
yep.
And it was originally funded out of MSD. I might be getting my facts wrong here, but we started. University of Auckland started or have held the contract for the last 5 or 6 years,
right.
6 years. And so we've essentially tried to restructure it a little bit by trying to make research more readily available. to sort of widen the scope of the clearinghouse so that NGOs can really access all that research information that they need to sort of lobby, and also it allows policy analysts to access, you know, high quality research.
And what sort? I mean, what sort of with the data that you do collate, the what sort of people use it? It's used in what sort of way?
It's used a lot for funding applications. So we have a lot of NGOs will access the data summaries, and they'll, you know, use the headlines, I guess, as much as anything to sort of reinforce the importance of addressing the issue of family violence. And through
that's the key to it, the importance of dealing with the issue of family violence.
So, yeah. So we're essentially trying to keep it current, keep it topical. I mean, you care what you count, right?
Mm.
Or you count what you care. So where we're not counting, we're not caring, essentially. And in some ways it's, you know, a little bit of self-flagellation all over again, but really it's something that we need to address. We need to keep publishing it in order to keep it on the headlines.
Yeah, and the these latest figures are quite mind-blowing, quite stunning, aren't they? That's when you're preparing to publish a collection of figures like this and these statistics, how do you sort of go, how do we get this through to people? Apart from get on BFM and talk about it, what's the technique? That must be so frustrating.
It is.
When what we're trying to do essentially is make the country a better place.
We are, and I think that we do run the risk of always being a bad news story. You know, that is one of the challenges we have. We can change the conversation around a wee bit, though. I think there are opportunities out of this to start focusing on what are some of the other questions that we can be asking. So we included the Family Violence Death Review Committee's data in our report. And if you look at their report, this is actually fascinating. They've got where Māori are in the higher socioeconomic groups, there's like no offenders and maybe one death. And it's like, why don't we ask the question of what's going right there? Rather than keeping saying to us, okay, asking ourselves all the time, what are we doing wrong? Because I think we know what we're doing wrong. We've got the answers for what we're doing wrong. We should be turning some of the questions around and starting to say, okay, what can we start doing right? And there are some wider social issues that we just need to address.
Like you mentioned before with Jemina, but do you want to just run through those again? Because I thought they were really important.
Yeah, so, I mean, like we've had a lot of media coverage recently about the inadequacy of mental health care in New Zealand. Why don't we start addressing that? Because when we start addressing that, we can start addressing family violence. Drug and alcohol issues, start addressing family violence. These are all issues that are related to family violence. Things like housing. When we start addressing housing, we start addressing family violence. When we start addressing pay equity so that women are earning just as much as men for similar jobs, then we start addressing family violence. Because where we have power and differences, we have an increased likelihood of violence occurring. So where we have those power differences through socioeconomic status or through gender or through ethnicity, then we know that those are going to there's an increased risk of violence occurring. So if we start saying, okay, let's start addressing these issues, because we know they're there and we can address them, we've just got to start taking them seriously.
How much of what happens in the home in New Zealand is just generational? Yeah, I know that. I know that's sort of the excuse a lot of the time. But do you find it's, you know?
Yeah, there are issues around generational violence, intergenerational violence. But again, we can address those where we help people to recover from the violence that they've experienced in childhood. Then we're less likely to create future perpetrators.
And that comes down to mental health and
mental
support,
health.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Somewhere you can talk to, you know, somebody or some place you can go to talk, you know, and discuss these things and not feel that you're a loser because, you know, you've done that before or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Or just these specialist family violence services. So where we have services that allow people to access the help that they need. There's an integrated safety response pilot happening down in Christchurch. One of the big things that came out of that was the extra services that they needed around to support people who've experienced violence. So that is the whole drug and alcohol, mental health, all those sorts of issues. And we're not particularly good at helping people to recover. So, in order to stop that intergenerational flow, we actually need to be helping people to recover.
To heal.
To recover from their trauma.
Yep. So let's get to the statistics that you guys have released today. The family violence investigations from the police reached a record high last year. 118,910 incidents of family violence. I'll get that number again. 118,910 incidents of family violence. And that's stunning. That's that's up by 8,000 from the year before. It could be 8,000 more people reporting or the police call outs in response to a different social attitude towards it. But it's just still an alarming figure. I mean, we're human beings. We're all grown human beings. It's like, how does this happen? How do we get such staggering numbers?
I don't know, but the general consensus is that this is largely driven by increased number of people coming forward. If that's the case, then that's something.
It's sort of an easy out, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree, because we don't know. We don't know if it's just due to increased number of people coming forward, and we need to get down to the bottom of that. If it's not just about that, then why have we got another 8,000 call-outs? Yeah. And some of that will be people who are calling out more than once. So, where you have repeat call-outs, then you've got major issues because people are phoning the police over and over again. So why is it that we're not getting those people to a place of safety so that they don't have to keep phoning, So there's something about response there as well.
I can't help but think when you say here that 41% of frontline police officers' time is responding to family violence.
It's big.
41%. So we know that sort of alcohol has got to 70% of police call-outs are related to alcohol. So that's, like you said before, alcohol and drugs is one thing, one of the things that can increase. When people talk about our alcohol laws and relaxed alcohol laws, it's a serious thing. It's not just kids are preloading before they go into town. It's families are being destroyed by things like that.
We know that there is an association between alcohol consumption and violence. So where you are experiencing violence and there's alcohol associated with it, you're more likely to get hurt more. So alcohol's not necessarily an excuse for violence either. Aren't violent just because they've had something to drink. That's not the precursor that sets them off. It's strongly associated with violence, and it's strongly associated with the severity of violence as well. And I think, you raise a really, really good point. That's 41% of police time. What else could police be doing?
Police is like that's the last resort. The police have to walk in there and establish what's going on, and then it either goes to court and there's charges and da 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 da, or there's a hey, don't do it again. You guys need to calm down, sort this out, talk to somebody. Police can only do so much, during those call outs.
I agree. What are the resources that police are able to access? And I think that's really, really important. If police aren't able to access any resources and say, okay, well, let's get this person to a place of safety, then we're just going to have a repeat call out, right? It's just going to be a recurring nightmare. So it's about what are the resources that we can then access for those people who have taken the step to pick up the phone and call the police? Because as you say, it's a really, really significant step for somebody to take.
Yeah.
Nobody does that sort of thing lightly.
No, and that sort of thing changes a relationship forever.
Yes, indeed.
Forever and ever and ever, ever. You heal it later on or not. Another thing that's come out today is that the victim's relationship to the offender is not being recorded in the majority of the cases, which seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's the police not getting that information.
Yeah, it's one of these things that we find a wee bit troubling. So the police have sort of restructured their data collection system so that they're now able to identify the relationship between the victim and the offender. And we found that around 50% of cases where you've got a male assault female offence, then we don't have that relationship established. So we don't know if it's a partner, we don't know if it's a stranger, we don't know if it's somebody that's not.
Why on earth would you not record that?
I don't know.
How hard is that question to ask?
Well, and I suppose, like, it's you know, would we accept this in other data sets? You know, if
absolutely not.
Exactly.
It's so half-assed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, has the investment been put in place to ensure that people know what they've got to do when they're collecting the information? Now, arguably, police know.
Surely you write down who it was and the relationship. Yeah, if you get pulled over by the cops or something else, you know, say you get caught for shoplifting or something like that, and there's two of you, it's like, how do you know this guy? Sort of thing. You know, that's one of the first questions they ask, aren't
you? You'd expect so. And we're, you know, if we've got these sorts of problems with the police data set, you know, it sort of raises questions about that whole social investment approach thing as well, where we're fully dependent on administrative data sets, and we're saying that actually those administrative data sets are fit for purpose for, you know, directing policy change over time. I'd argue that maybe they're not. You know, if we've got these sorts of things happening in the police data set, what's happening in child, youth and family, do we know that the quality of data is good enough that we can make policy decisions based on that information over time? I'm not sure we've asked that question.
Yep.
And I don't think we've put the training up front to ensure that people know what sort of data they're expected to collect to allow those policy decisions to be made.
So it's a training thing, which in turn is like a money thing going into police.
Yeah, yeah, it is training. I mean, it does come down to training. It comes down to resources.
Identifying which information is vital.
As important, yeah. And this is a lost opportunity. You know, where we have 50% of assaults against female not having a relationship established, we've got almost 75% of sexual assaults that don't have a relationship established, and you can't tell me
what the fucking fuck.
Yeah, I know. It's just
excuse my language.
It seems to me that those are really, really useful bits of information, and it's a lost opportunity both for people outside of the police and the police themselves to be directing their activities over time.
I can't imagine if someone must have asked that question. Why is that not recorded? Why is that information not recorded? I can't imagine an answer that would be possible, other than, yes, we should do that.
Yes.
You know? And between 2009 and 2015, 194. That's just in that short time, between 2009 and 2015, 194 family violence deaths with intimate partner violence, which is that's your partner, making up almost half of those, 92 deaths. That's dead people. It's people dying because of an escalation of anger or whatever, or power or whatever it is in the home in New Zealand. That's happening.
Yeah.
That's happening.
Yeah. And the Family Violence Death Review Committee put together some really, really, really useful reports. And, you know, the quality of information that's contained in those reports is amazing. And that's just one of the headline figures that comes out of that. But I think that they allow us to disentangle things like power and control, and where we have real risk factors. And the Death Review Committee are saying over and over again, we need to be putting in place a system to respond to violence. We can't allow these sorts of things to carry on, because generally those people were making contact with police. They were trying to find help. They were making contact with friends and family.
That's so sad. Wow.
Yeah. They were looking for help. And a lot of the time, women were trying to leave a violent relationship as well. So it's not like they're not trying to get themselves safe, but they need help to get themselves safe. And that's what the Death Review Committee is saying, is that actually we're not putting a system in place that gets a person to safety. Getting a person to safety is not like 2 weeks. That doesn't happen. It's a long-term event, right?
It's not fill in a form.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not get yourself a police safety order or a protection order. That's not safety. That's just an administrative form.
In 2015, just in that 1 year, in 2015, New Zealand police recorded 10 homicides of children and young people under 20 by a family member. 10 people died. 63 children aged 16 years or under were hospitalised for an assault perpetrated by a family member. 63 children.
Unfortunately, that's likely to be an undercount as well, because that's only where we record And hospitalised assaults, we only record where we're really, really sure that it's an assault and we're really sure of who the perpetrator was.
Imagine a room with 63 children in it. Just imagine 63 individual children in it. And then that's 63 children. You know, people, you don't think like that, do you? Just when the figures come up, 194 people, 194 family violence deaths. Think of a room with 194 people in it.
Yeah.
All those people, all those individual lives and all that sort of stuff. And this is what I always, this is the thing that freaks me out. I just don't understand how it gets by so many people. You know, like I know there's been ad campaigns in the past of sort of, if you see it happening, speak up sort of thing. But I just, there's got to be a huge amount of people in this country who just turned a blind eye. There's got to be, surely.
Yeah.
I know that's not you know, it's hard to tell. You know, that's not what you bring to the table today. But I mean, that's a thing that really just freaks me out. I can't believe these figures that are so bad and don't seem to change. Just seem to get worse. And there's got to be people out there who are just going, oh, I'm not going to say anything.
Though, I mean, I'd argue that there are people who are trying to help. There are people who will walk alongside women and children trying to seek a way of getting out of those violent relationships. And at the end of the day, what they get told by our current system is that she needs to make the move. She needs to leave the house, irrespective of the fact.
He's just out of control, and the best thing you can do is just to keep away from him.
And she's.
Why don't you just stop him being out of control? Isn't that the key?
Yeah, maybe, and chances are she doesn't have the financial resources to leave the house. She doesn't have the house. She doesn't have a place to take her kids. Hmm. You know, that we are asking.
And our jails are chock a block full of people. They can't just chuck everybody in there, can they? Imagine if everyone, they arrested everyone from those 41% of police call outs. We'd have to get 20 more jails.
So when you say satellite entities need more funding, is that things like Women's Refuge and Child, Youth and Family, or like completely new institutions altogether should be?
I mean, if we take a look at what's happening in Victoria at the moment, so Australia across the ditch, they've just invested about $2 billion in having a well-designed, strategically planned system for addressing family violence. So they're talking about adequately training responses. They're talking about having housing available for people who want to leave violent situations. They're ensuring that they've got really, really, really good prevention campaigns. They're allowing kids to recover from experiences of violence. All those sorts of things that we're calling for. So that's
the difference with all that stuff is it's not ambulance at the bottom of the cliff stuff.
It's prevention.
Way before that.
Yes.
Which is really important. Yeah.
And they're also talking about ensuring that kids get adequate education on, you know, establishing respectful relationships through primary school, through secondary school, through, you know. I mean, these are really, really useful bits of information that kids, we're just sort of expecting our kids to pick up by chance at the moment. And we need, you know, strong role models. So, sorry, I've almost forgotten what you asked me.
No, you nailed it.
That's okay.
I'd like to talk about this forever, Pauline, but thank you so much for coming in, Dr. Pauline Gulliver from the Family Violence Clearinghouse. And these figures are so important, and the work you guys are doing is really important. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
We're going to talk about more. This will be talked about more on The Wire, and you should be talking about it with your friends, surely. Surely. Thanks for coming in. Cheers.
Steady Learn, thanks to the University of Auckland, the best university.
And if you want to know how much the government spends on violence prevention at the moment, how much do you think? What percentage? 1.5% of the government spend. 1.5%. Now, if you do know somebody that's experiencing family violence, or you yourself are experiencing family violence, or you need to talk to somebody, there are many, many places you can go. Pauline suggests the number one go-to place is Shine. You got that? And Women's Refuge, of course, if all you can do is think about this today, then please think about it. That's all we ask.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.